So welcome to the Texas Observer Podcast. This is our third edition in our new series, coming to you from the fallout shelter in the basement of the Observer office, which actually is a fallout shelter. We're joined this week by Forrest Wilder, staff writer with the Texas Observer, and Cindy Casares, a columnist with the Observer. Welcome.
Thank you, Dave Mann, editor-in-chief of the Texas Observer.
So, we wanted to talk this week about the unveiling of the Tejano Monument and also about the recent ruling on the Open Beaches Act from the Texas Supreme Court. Let's talk first about the Tejano Monument. Cindy, this was kind of a long time coming.
Yes, 500 years.
Yeah. And even more recently, kind of 10 years in the making. Tell us a little bit about kind of how the movement for a Tejano Monument got started.
Sure. So roughly about 10 years ago, there was a doctor from McAllen who was touring the Capitol grounds in Austin, and he noticed that there were no statues of any kind depicting Texans of Hispanic descent in any sort of positive light. So he went home and started talking with his friends, and they decided that they should put together some kind of coalition to lobby for a statue dedicated to the Tejano people, which is what Texans of Mexican and Spanish descent call themselves. So they formed the Tejano Monument Commission, it's called, and they just started lobbying, and it took 10 years of passing about three different bills through the Senate and House to get first the funds. I think it ultimately cost about $1.8 million to build this statuary, which is 500 some square feet. And then they had to pass a bill to get it placed on the South Lawn, which is the front yard, that's what I like to call it, of the Capitol. There was some dissent originally from some legislatures who said that, you know, they didn't feel Hispanic Texans deserved to be in the South Lawn. And there was, like, you know, back and forth about that. But
now, just to be clear, the South Lawn has like a Confederate monument and like what else is on there? There's a lot on there.
There's a firefighter I saw.
There's some veteran memorials. But it's interesting also that it faces south. I think that's, you know, something to note about the sort of architecture of the Capitol grounds.
Yeah, well, all the state buildings, I know because I used to be a Senate messenger way back in the day, and all the state office buildings face south.
Mexico.
Yeah, towards Mexico. No, it is purposefully to turn their back on the north, and none of the statues face north. They might face east or west, but nothing faces north. The same with the tower at UT faces south. The main administrative building, everything faces south, all those statues.
I didn't know any of that.
Yeah. So it's the South Lawn is the front of the Capitol. So it actually ended up, they got a really prominent placement. I guess it would be the southeast corner right on 11th Street and Congress. If you come up on Congress, it's to the right. And so it was a really big deal because Hispanic Texans, it's hard to believe, have no sort of official acknowledgement for any of the contributions they've made to the state, even though, you know, they were here first and they brought so much to the culture of Texas.
Symbolically, what did this mean for the Latino community of Tejanos?
I mean, I think it was a really happy day because, you know, it's just, well, I'll quote what one historian said in his speech that day, which I just thought was so great. He's a professor of history from ACC, and his name is Andres Tijerina, sorry, doctor of history. And basically what he told the crowd was that everything that Texans brag about as being Texan was brought to the state by Tejanos, or, you know, the people coming from Spain. They brought the cattle industry and everything about cowboying, like the clothes, the words, everything. They brought mounted law enforcement, which was ironically copied by the Texas Rangers, who then turned around and lynched a lot of Mexicans, but that's another story. They brought, you know, the legal system the United States copied, the Spanish Tejano homestead and community property laws. There was just so much that Hispanic Texans brought to the party that has just been, you know, ignored. And there's just like this big chunk of our collective history as a state, and especially if you are Tejano, it's like you kind of know this stuff, but you don't really know it because it's not taught in school. And it's just like this, you know, elephant that no one talks about, or this sort of like, not to be vulgar, but this sort of, you know, bastard child at the table that no one wants to discuss. And so I think it was actually a really nice moment to have the state, you know, say, you know, we acknowledge you, you've been here. The governor was there, the lieutenant governor was there. I think it was the first Latina state Supreme Court justice was there. You know, a lot of legislators were there. So it was like a really official event. And I think it was a really happy day for a lot of people.
So I thought it was interesting because, like you're talking about, the symbolism of the monument being installed in the Capitol grounds is huge. But there's been less talk about what the monument actually looks like, what it depicts, mm-hmm. what it kind of means, what the artist's intentions were. Is that, can you talk a little bit about?
Sure. The artist is from Laredo, and he, you know, he won the job 10 years ago. I've read some interviews with him where he said that when he started the job, he didn't have any grandkids, and now he has 3 grandkids, and they're like kids, they're not babies. And he built a 525 square foot statuary, which means it's got multiple statues and they're all connected on a big rock. I believe it's granite. And, it basically depicts just various, he just sort of chose various, I guess, iconic symbols of early Hispanic Texan culture. So the first one is like a Spanish conquistador, and he has like the baggy pantaloons, and he's kind of looking off into the distance with his hand over his eyes, and he's got that conquistador helmet on. And then there's a charro, which is a Mexican cowboy, you know, a guy mounted on a horse, and that's probably the one that Tejanos love the most, especially the men. When it was time, they unveiled each one separately, and when it was time to unveil that one, like all the male dignitaries like ran over, like they wanted to be the one to unveil the charro. I just think it's funny, the men and their cowboy fantasies. There was several family figures, because I think the artist felt that family is very integral to Tejano culture and Hispanic culture. So there was the mom and the dad, who were like peasant sort of farmers, and there was a young son who was tending the goats and sheep, and there's a young girl who's collecting water, and all of these things were meant to symbolize what the sort of day-to-day work and life was like for the early Tejano settlers. And I'm trying to remember what else is in there. I think that's all the pieces. I'm not 100% sure, because I've only seen it one time, but it's just got several different iconic figures like that. And then there are plaques at the bottom, like about 3 or 4 plaques that give more historical context to important periods in Tejano history, including important battles that were fought by largely Hispanic Texan troops when they were fighting for independence for Texas and that sort of thing. So
it's interesting because it does hit a lot of the iconography of Anglo Texans, you know, right. The cowboy, the kind of like ranching, muscular, you know, masculine kind of culture. So it seems, in a sense, that it's very mainstream. It fits in the popular conception of like Texans, regardless of your.
Yeah. And I think that's what, one of the things that Dr. Tijerina was saying was, every Texan lives a part of the Tejano legacy, but they don't even necessarily know it. And so, in fact, he said, if you took the Tejano legacy out of Texas, you'd be left with Ohio.
That'd be kind of a bummer. No offense, Ohio.
Although I think Ohio does have chili, so they're like Cincinnati chili or something. But anyway,
Chili's the chain restaurant. Yeah, I bet you they do have one of those awesome blossoms or whatever.
I think they put beans in it, though.
Do you think that this attitude is starting to change You think that the Tejano Monument is representing the state changing a little bit, or is it more like we're still the same, we just built a monument? I mean,
honestly, my gut feeling is that what's changed is the sense of entitlement of the Hispanic people in Texas more than anything. I think that's what's changed. I unfortunately don't think that the majority in power right now are necessarily really trying to embrace or embrace the Tejano inside of themselves or admit to that, having that cultural heritage. And obviously there's, you know, the rampant anti-immigrant Hispanic sentiment that's going on right now in this country. So no, I do think though that the Hispanic side is growing in entitlement, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's probably the way it's going to happen in any society. I mean, the ones that are comfortable and in power, they have no impetus for change, but the ones that want, you know, they want things to change, they're the ones that are going to make a change. So in that way, I think it's progress.
A little bit of an aside, but is there an African-American
monument?
You
know, I don't know.
And I feel ashamed I don't know this because
having
spent a lot of time at the Capitol, you just tend not to notice the monuments.
It's not like
set pieces, you know. Almost.
It's not like I've gone around looking at all the Anglo monuments either.
Right.
Of course, it's funny because once the monument was built, then I was like, wait, why isn't it inside? You know, they put the Mexicans in the yard. Like, I started to get paranoid. But I don't know. I don't know if there's any. I mean, I can't recall any off the top of my head. I don't frequent the Capitol, but I was just there for these festivities, and I didn't spot anything. But that doesn't mean it's not there.
Yeah.
Can't really say.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's police, fire, the Texas Children, Ten Commandments, Monument to the Ten Commandments, the Confederate one. Those are the only ones I know.
Right.
But there's a ton more that, when you're up there and you're working, you don't, they're just there and you know.
Yeah, you kind of go by them.
I guess one kind of issue here, though, is it kind of reminds me of a Texas history book. I can't remember what the 6th, 7th, or 8th grade in Texas you had to take a
7th.
Texas was a 7th grade. And there'd be these boxes, like the gray box, where they'd stick, like, prominent African-American historical figure, you know, then you'd go back to the sort of dominant narrative, which was, so there's a bit of like kind of a tokenism. And I don't think that's what's going on with the Tejano Monument, but there does seem to be like, well, okay, we got to have one monument for this group, another monument for that group. You do kind of run the risk of putting people in these boxes.
Yeah.
It seems like.
Yeah. And well, one of the cool things that came out of this whole initiative is that Walmart, of all people,
corporations are people, so yeah.
Yeah, they are people. Walmart donated a lot of money to fund an initiative at UT to start a curriculum on Tejano history for 4th graders. And I guess the pilot program is supposed to start in a couple of schools in Austin, AISD. And I guess the hope is that it will branch out from there. So I'm actually working on a larger feature about a particular battle that I learned about while researching this story, and I have talked to one of the women that worked on that curriculum, and she's really excited. They're actually training these master bilingual teachers, and it's going to be part of a bilingual curriculum where they teach the kids, I guess, in English and Spanish. So I guess slowly it's changing, you know. I think that the census coming out in 2010 saying that Texas is being overrun by Hispanics has really got people realizing, even for selfish reasons, they have to start serving this population. So, you know, it's just starting to manifest itself in all kinds of ways.
Well, we should, I think, maybe transition to talk a little about Texas beaches, which is another big issue. Forrest, you wrote a story for the Observer website at the end of last week, I guess, talking about the ruling from the Texas Supreme Court, which some people are saying gutted the Texas Open Beaches Act. I guess, first off, you know, when I moved to Texas, I'd never heard of the Texas Open Beaches Act. What is the Texas Open Beaches Act?
Well, it's a law that dates from the 1950s, I believe, 1959. And essentially codified this historical right of access for the public to use the beach as basically between the ocean and the line of vegetation. And I believe it's the strongest law of its type in the country. I mean, you go to other states and beaches are, you know, largely private, or there's just kind of a mix, like a little pocket beach and then a lot of private beaches. They're fenced. They're hard to access. Texas, it's interesting given how much of the land here is privately owned that we've had such a long historical and legal right to use the beach freely and for the whole stretch of the coastline, with just a handful of exceptions from, you know, South Padre Island all the way up to the Louisiana line. So that's now in jeopardy a little bit because of this decision.
Okay, so I mean, it sounds pretty good. Everybody can go to the beach and drive on the beach and fish off the back of your pickup and all that. So what's the problem?
Well, the Supreme Court said, and I'm going to boil it down here a little bit, is that when there is a storm or an evulsive event, as it's called, the easement that guarantees the public's right of access to the dry beach, as it's called, doesn't roll. So, you know, beaches are constantly eroding or accreting. The beach can be pushed back onto private property, you know, overnight when there's a hurricane or a storm. So the question that they were posed with primarily was, does the easement roll? Traditionally, the answer to that has been yes, and the General Land Office enforces that easement by making people move their homes when the public beach conflicts with their property.
So if I have a beachfront house and I run on the public beach, and then all of a sudden some storm comes in and erodes half the beach away, and all of a sudden the public beach is now sitting in my front deck, I've actually got to move my house back because I'm now on public land.
That's the way it's been. And there's been, I mean, you know, exactly how to enforce that has been a contention for a long time. You know, a lot of public beach advocates were not too crazy about how the General Land Office was, they thought, having a soft touch with some property owners. The thing is, when you buy property that's, you know, right on the ocean, on the Gulf, one of the documents you sign is acknowledging the fact that your property is at risk of being condemned if, you know, your home ends up on the public beach. So now that's sort of been eviscerated, because what the court said is that while the easement does roll during the normal course of erosion, it does not move or roll in the event of a storm.
Well, how do they figure that?
The dissenting opinion said, I mean, they said this distinction between this regular erosion, these evulsive events, really makes no sense. That was the dissenting opinion. Three justices dissented from the five that wrote the majority or signed on to the majority opinion. One interesting thing is that the majority said the state could not prove that there was a public easement, because in 1840, when the Republic of Texas basically handed over deeds to private landowners on Galveston Island, there was no express public easement that was written into these patents or deeds, as they were called. That was in 1840. So you can't prove a public easement, then there's no right of access.
1840 was a hell of a year on the beach, I have to say.
Yeah.
So they're going all the way back, what, 170 years to try to, like, to undermine a law that was written 60-something years ago? Why is that superseding?
Well, actually, the story goes back about 200 years. The Open Beaches Act, which is now actually codified and incorporated into the Texas Constitution because voters approved a measure in 2009 doing that, was an attempt to sort of say, to put into law a practice and a common law that goes back 200 years to the times before Texas was a state or a republic, it was in Spanish control. It was assumed that people had a right to use the beach. They did use the beach, and that continued up until the 1950s when there started to be some fencing. There was a public outcry, like, you know, this right that we have is being infringed by a handful of people. They're trying to put up fencing. The Texas legislature said, okay, well, we'll take care of that. We'll pass the Open Beaches Act, sort of putting into statute the public's long-held 150-something-year right to use the public beaches. So fast forward to 2012, the Texas Supreme Court is saying, well, no, in fact, what the Open Beaches Act says is you've got a right of access if you can prove an easement. But the state can't necessarily prove an easement. And in the case of West Galveston, they definitely have not. So the practical fallout is that probably this is going to tie the state up in litigation on a sort of like beach by beach, property by property basis, and throw into question whether there is a public beach up and down the Texas coast.
So wherever there's a dispute with a landowner, they have to go property by property and actually prove that they have a quote-unquote easement.
Yeah, especially, I mean, in the event of, especially after a storm. I mean, overnight, this has happened. It happened in Galveston. In fact, that's where this lawsuit comes from. 2005, Hurricane Rita hit Galveston pretty hard, pushed the beach back significantly. The woman who's Carol Severance is a California attorney who had bought properties on the west end of Galveston before the storm. The storm hit. Suddenly her homes were, you know, on the public beach. The GLO said, okay, you got to move them. They have a buyout program. She said no. Hooked up with the Pacific Legal Institute, which is a private property rights legal outfit out of California. They sued the state. 7 years later, she prevails. So even though she doesn't own the homes anymore.
So let's get this straight. So we've got this woman from California where they have private beaches, right? And she's going to come into Texas where we have this great beaches are open for all and undermine our six-year-old law. And now we're probably going to have some private beaches in the state thanks to this woman from California. Is that my understanding here?
Yeah, basically. And that's, I mean, you know, Jerry Patterson sort of peeling himself off the ceiling right now. He's although he's had his critics about enforcing the Open Beaches Act, he has been a really strong and aggressive voice in pushing back against the Texas Supreme Court. And, you know, the irony of this California attorney sort of coming into Texas and eviscerating what is a law and a right, I guess, that had been enjoyed by people in the state for 200 years is outrageous to some. In fact, Patterson is basically going around saying we need to kick the five justices off the bench because, you know, we elect our Supreme Court justices here in Texas. Even Greg Abbott said this is an act of this is judicial activism that these judges have engaged in. That's like, you know, calling one conservative calling another conservative a judicial activist is sort of like a swear word, you know. They're bad-mouthing them pretty good.
I mean, I grew up 20 minutes from South Padre Island, so if that ever got fenced up, I would hate that. I never thought about that. Are we? Did you say we're the only ones in the country?
I think Maine has a similar law, but what I've read and heard is that, you know, Texas probably has the strongest law, and I think it's so important to people because we have so little public land, especially public lands accessible to people in the urban areas of the state. Mm-hmm. And like I grew up, most of my family's from Corpus. I mean, yeah, just like you, we took it for granted that, you know, you go to the beach and you can drive your truck down the beach and you can sit up and surf fish and pretty much wherever you want, with a few exceptions.
And when I lived on the East Coast, like in New Jersey, it's so not like that. You're constantly walking, like trying to find a place to enter the beach. Because everything's fenced off by private homes and such. Same with California.
Yeah.
That would be really, really a shame if that went away.
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's some question about exactly what the fallout is going to look like. But among the kind of defenders and proponents of the law, I think there's something of a consensus that at a minimum, there's going to be a lot of litigation. A lot of this is going to be up to what the property owners on the beach are going to do. If they want to make a huge issue of it, say somebody on, you know, I don't know, Mustang Island or the part of Padre Island that's privately owned, wanting to go put up a fence. Well, I mean, this is the type of thing that is going to end up in court, and it could end up being this sort of piecemeal, like beach by beach fight that could go on indefinitely. Another thing is Jerry Patterson has said, well, you know, we're not going to do any more beach nourishment projects for the west end of Galveston. That's over. Galveston Island is one of the fastest eroding parts of the U.S. They're losing 6 to 7 feet of beach every year. So ironically, these property owners are on the front rows of the beach are big proponents of hey, let's get the taxpayer to bring in sand and dump it on our beach so we can have a nice wide beach to enjoy and not have our home end up in the Gulf. So Patterson's basically saying, well, we're not going to do that anymore. That's, oh, you want to, that beach is yours to deal with now. And the taxpayer is certainly not going to put any money into it if you're not going to, you know, if the law is not going to reflect the public right of access. So
that makes sense. So no public beach, there's going to be no beach basically in Galveston. But in other parts of the state, it seems like there will be fences, there will be private beaches. It's one of these things where, like, if people can, they will. Even if it takes a little bit of, like, legal wrangling, if people can create a, are allowed to create a private beach, why wouldn't they? You know, it's,
yeah,
they have their home on the beachfront. You know, you can hear the justifications. Well, I pay a lot of money for this house, blah, blah, blah. You know, we deserve to have the private beach. People don't think, you know, not everyone else in those instances.
Well, and it only takes one fence to stop somebody from driving down a beach. I mean, even if a lot of the people who own property are sort of, you know, cool about it, a lot of people own second homes and they're just not in the business of, like, trying to, you know, scare people off the beach. You know, it doesn't take that many people putting up fences.
Well, and there's hotels too. There's hotels on the beach and they could fence off, and you go see all these places with resorts, you know, all over the place where they have, you know, they advertise their private beaches.
Yeah.
And you can totally see that happening.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, it's, I hate to say slippery slope, but slippery shoreline.
Yeah, exactly.
Eroding even.
Encroaching tide. How many metaphors can we use?
I mean, I think, and one of the sort of side notes here is that, I mean, while the court, including the majority, recognized that the property boundaries and the easement are dynamic in the sense that, you know, it's not a fixed
beach
boundary.
Moves.
The beach moves. There, I felt like there was an insufficient kind of reckoning with the fact that these beaches, they're not just shifting. They are rapidly eroding. And in fact, that rate of erosion is accelerating as sea level rise starts to accelerate. So, I mean, Galveston probably, just talking about Galveston, has maybe ultimately bigger problems than just the legal wrangling over where exactly the public easement is or is not. I mean, that's the fundamental fact of life on the island now, is that they are just sort of, it's shrinking. And there's a lot of homes that have been built there, you know, over the past few decades on the West End that's not protected by the seawall. So this conflict between, like, nature and property rights and the public's right of access is probably only going to become more contentious, and this decision doesn't really address that at all.
Yeah, we might see some homes washed away in the West End there.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of stuff moves in slow motion, but that's starting to kind of pick up speed, you know, as the sort of rate of erosion increases. So.
But there are parts of the beach that are protected, right? That that are just like Boca Chica Beach,
right? Well, the National Seashore, of course, Galveston State Park, and all the state parks. I mean, I'll see how this would apply because there's no private property owner to sort of, you know, contest the easement. So, I mean, that's all kind of carved out of this law. So, I mean, I guess there's, I don't know if that's a silver lining, but, you know, people don't have to worry about anything changing on the National Seashore.
Just wait till the budget gets bad enough and we'll sell that off to some resort developer. Right. Not to be too cynical about it, but Texas Parks and Wildlife did have a budget cut.
That's true, that's true, yeah.
Well, I want to thank Forrest and Cindy for joining us on our third edition of the Texas Observer podcast.
Thank you.
And we'll have another edition in 2 weeks.